My name is Laura Dawn, and you're listening to a very special episode of the Psychedelic Leadership Podcast, featuring my conversation with two truly incredible human beings. Cody Swift is a philanthropist, a licensed psychotherapist, and executive director of the River Styx Foundation, and Miriam Bolat, who is the co-director of River Styx and the co-director of the Indigenous Medicine Conservation Fund.
If you really look out 100 years at where we're going to be with this psychedelic movement that's happening and what do we want, and then also, you know, Laura Dawn is a systems thinker, then what are some of the unintended consequences? And it's unequivocally clear that if we get 40 or 50 years down the road and the psychedelic movement or all of that actually just put more pressure on these communities and skipped over the opportunity to do benefit sharing and even change some of their behaviors, that it was gonna, I don't know, for lack of a better word, just feel terrible. Sometimes I've been being a little bit dramatic and say it will have failed because it will have caused more trauma than MDMA or any of these could ever address. And I don't know that, but I think really it was that serious. This was really, really urgently important to address.
There were these traditions, Indigenous traditions, who, despite all the traumas and the colonialization and everything, all the difficulties that they faced, they managed to really preserve that thread of tradition and spirituality and having this really remarkable tool and ceremony and culture in place that could help reinforce and recondition and reconnect to the core elements of life, to the water, to the fire, to earth and air.
It's particularly important to point out that the psychedelic space is moving very, very quickly. And it's been a challenge, and I think will continue to be a challenge, to make sure that we're honoring the pace of governance in these communities while navigating really supporting the psychedelic community to hear these narratives around benefit sharing, around the responsibility to actually maintain and ensure access into the future of these communities, while the pacing is slightly different, right? The pacing of Silicon Valley and the pacing of this iterative, representative, Indigenous worldview process, they're very different.
I am so thrilled to be featuring both Cody Swift and Miriam Bolat on the podcast today, because the work that they're doing with River Styx Foundation and the Indigenous Medicine Conservation Fund is truly unprecedented and so remarkable. And I'm excited for them to share the origin stories of these initiatives, not only because they are templating and modeling a new philanthropic paradigm, especially in the psychedelic space, but also because it weaves together with the origin story of Grow Medicine, which is a project I'm helping to steward. And through a partnership collaboration, Grow Medicine is a project of the Indigenous Medicine Conservation Fund. And I'll share a little bit more about Grow before we dive in. But I know some of you listening have been tracking my journey with Grow Medicine for a while. Some of you might be wondering, wait a second, I thought you were launching that last year. Well, I was about to launch until I met Miriam from the Indigenous Medicine Conservation Fund. And through conversations that we had, I decided to join the fund and have a partnership agreement with them. So now Grow is a project of the fund, and it's really an integrated part of the fund and its mission. So for this episode, I really want to highlight the work that Cody and Miriam have been doing at River Styx Foundation, because River Styx, along with Dr. Bronners and other unnamed philanthropists, really helped to birth the Indigenous Medicine Conservation Fund, which is so incredibly needed, especially right now, because we are approaching a crucial tipping point in the psychedelic movement. As these medicines rapidly enter Western culture, this rise in demand is placing significant pressures on the Indigenous communities and biocultures and their medicines. And as the world comes to embrace the healing potential of sacred medicines, how do we ensure the original stewards of these medicines are uplifted, honored, and supported in this search for our collective healing? And how do we step towards right relationship and ensure that these biocultures thrive for generations to come? And really, this is the essence of the work that the Indigenous Medicine Conservation Fund is doing, and by extension, Grow Medicine as well. And so before I share a little bit more about the mission of the Indigenous Medicine Conservation Fund, the IMC Fund, I just want to share a little bit about Miriam and Cody's background so you can really see the incredible work that these two are doing. So Miriam is the co-director of the Indigenous Medicine Conservation Fund. She's a researcher, an educator, a facilitator, and also an ecologist. She's also a mother, and she's the executive director of IPCI, the Indigenous Peyote Conservation Initiative, and sits on the board of MAPS Public Benefit Corporation. And she is just so passionate about biocultural conservation, and I just feel so fortunate to have learned an enormous amount from her, especially over the past 6 months. And Cody Swift is a philanthropist, a qualitative researcher, a licensed psychotherapist, and through the River Styx Foundation, he has collaborated extensively on projects addressing healthy society through working with stigmatized populations and issues. And those are the most likely to be overlooked for funding and support. And since 2007, he's helped to fund over 20 psychedelic research trials. He has served as a therapist guide in the Johns Hopkins psilocybin and cancer anxiety study, and has conducted dozens of qualitative interviews with study subjects into the subjective aspects of their experience with psilocybin and MDMA. He has truly dedicated himself to this field, not only because of the efficacy of these medicines, but because of the way they heal by helping individuals to turn towards difficult or painful aspects of their lives, to reconcile them into greater wholeness and gain perspective on life beyond illness. He has a passion for reinvigorating religious traditions through psychedelics and has also worked for over 7 years supporting Indigenous communities in the conservation of their sacred plant medicines, such as the Native American Church, in the preservation of peyote, and the Indigenous Medicine Conservation Fund. And Cody is honestly just such a kind-hearted human being, and both Miriam and Cody are doing such incredible work. And they bring such a depth of perspective to some of these very crucial issues that we are facing in the psychedelic space right now, especially these topics around reciprocity and plant medicine conservation and being in right relationship with Indigenous cultures and communities that have been stewarding these medicines, and the importance of supporting Indigenous communities so that they can continue to thrive. But even understanding how to go about doing that is actually not so straightforward. And through their depth of understanding, through their years of experience, they're really able to shed light on some of the nuance of these topics and also highlight the importance of the words that we choose. And that's been a big learning curve for me in this process, is that how we talk about these topics and the specific words we choose is actually really, really important. It's like understanding the difference between reciprocity and benefit sharing, which Miriam will speak to in this conversation. And so I really just want to elevate their voices, give them space to share their perspective so you can learn about how they're thinking about these topics. And my hope is that they will influence how you think about these topics as well, because we all know that the narratives we tell ourselves repeatedly, those narratives actually inform our behavior and the actions that we take. And we are actually needing to really consider our actions, especially our choices around plant medicine consumption. And to further set the context for this episode, one thing I didn't ask Miriam explicitly in this conversation was to share the mission of the Indigenous Medicine Conservation Fund. So I wanted to share it with you before we dive in, because it's really such a powerful mission, and I want to illuminate the magnitude of what the fund is really doing. And so the IMC Fund is working to ensure a future where Indigenous peoples, their medicines, and knowledges thrive for generations to come. As an Indigenous-led philanthropic vehicle, we work to ensure the resilience of our peoples in the face of cultural appropriation, environmental extractivism, human rights violations, and climate change. By partnering with funders globally, informed by robust ecological and community-based assessments, we build alliances with organizations on the ground, fund their efforts, and do strategic engagement with leaders of each bioculture. And it really is such a powerful mission. And they are in the process of a $20 million philanthropic raise. And so if you know anyone who might be interested in supporting on a larger scale, you can learn more by going to imc.fund. The fund has 6 commitments, and I wanted to share those with you as well because it illuminates the mission in action. So the first commitment is to build a new philanthropic paradigm of right relationship and trust between Indigenous communities and funders. Number 2, ensure conservation strategies are Indigenous-led and strengthen the core principles of unity, territory, autonomy, and sustaining culture. Number 3, advance the realization and recognition of Indigenous peoples' rights. Number 4, work to ensure strategies are in place that reduce harm from increasing global pressure and strengthens traditional medicines and the Indigenous cultures that steward them. Number 5, amplify the voices of traditional knowledge holders and the crucial importance of the health of their cultures for humanity and the planet. And number 6, create a mechanism for benefit sharing for the psychedelic industry and the broader community. And this is where Grow Medicine comes in. And so Grow Medicine is like an extension of the fund. It's the forward-facing brand or the crowdfunding arm of the IMC fund. And so we have created an easy-to-use, mobile-friendly application that empowers the psychedelic and medicine community to step towards right relationship by donating to support plant medicine conservation, Indigenous sovereignty, and biocultural diversity. And we are going live May 31st. And starting that day, you can go to growmedicine.com, select the Keystone medicine you wish to directly support. Maybe this medicine has enriched your life in some way, and you'd like to support the bioculture and the communities that have been stewarding these medicines. And so there's 5 Keystone medicines that you can choose from: ayahuasca, peyote, iboga, mushrooms, or toad. And then you can pick your donation amount, and we encourage people to make this a monthly donation. So it's just a recurring amount that you contribute every single month. And your donation goes towards Indigenous-led initiatives that are strengthening their communities in their efforts to conserve Keystone plant medicines and traditional knowledges that they rely on for their healing and cultural survival. And after making a donation, scroll through the page and learn more about the risks and threats these Keystone medicines face and that their biocultures face, which is also part of the mission of Grow Medicine, is to help educate and inform people about the impact of our choices. And so the initiatives and Indigenous-led organizations we are featuring on Grow Medicine have gone through a very in-depth assessment process, and Miriam and Cody speak to this process in the conversation. And it's really all about building relationships, building trust, showing up and listening, and supporting these communities in a way that they are asking for, which is solidarity-based support. This is another term we're helping to grow awareness around. And you can learn more about this term and all of the narrative shifts that we're encouraging by going to growmedicine.com. And if you're listening to this before May 31st, we would so appreciate it if you could sign up to support the launch and share it with your communities. And we would really love your support in helping to amplify this message. We're really holding the vision that Grow Medicine becomes a fully integrated part of our psychedelic and medicine communities in Western culture. So again, I encourage you to check out imc.fund to learn more about the Indigenous Medicine Conservation Fund. And please check out growmedicine.com. Please be sure to follow at @supportgrowmedicine on Instagram and share it with your friends. And all of these resources and links that I'm mentioning throughout this intro and throughout the conversation can be found at lauradawn.co/54. Where you can also learn more about Miriam and Cody. You can read their bios are there, and you can also access a full transcript of this episode. And as per usual, I'll be featuring a song at the end of this episode, and I'll be leaving you with a song called The Power of Kindness by Mamuse, which is really the perfect fit for this episode, and I just love their music so much. It has truly enriched my life. All right, friends, as always, thank you so much for continuing to tune in to the Psychedelic Leadership Podcast. And without any further ado, here is my conversation with Miriam Volat and Cody Swift. Hi, Cody. Hi, Miriam. Thanks for joining me today. It's nice to have you guys here.
Thanks for having us, Laura Dawn.
I thought a good place to start would be for Cody, if you could introduce yourself, share a little bit about your background, and I would love to hear the origin story of River Styx Foundation.
Sure. So I am a licensed psychotherapist in California, and I've also been directing the River Styx Foundation for about 14 years. And Miriam came on about 5 or 6 years ago now as co-director. And River Styx is ostensibly a small family foundation. It's a grant-making foundation. So we do give grants, but we also initiate projects. And how it came about is really from my great-grandfather, who was an early involvement with UPS, United Parcel Service, and my grandmother left me this small foundation called River Styx. And so I was about 21 or 22 at the time and had just graduated with a degree in psychology and really taking on this responsibility of the foundation, which really didn't have a clear mission or vision. And so I was tasked with this very interesting challenge to look at the world's issues and problems and to try to figure out with a relatively small amount of money, you know, giving away $1 million, $1.5 million a year to try to make some kind of substantial difference in these gargantuan issues that we're facing today of climate change and massive economic disparities and, you know, really a psychological, spiritual crisis of meaning and purpose and addiction and depression. And so I spent many, many years just in this deep, deep grappling, really my own existential struggle with how do you begin addressing some of these issues? And through my own process and from my training in psychology, really coming to understand that our collective latent anxieties are really fueling each of these major crises in the world, from climate change to economic disparities, even that from our collective anxiety, we're driven towards this compulsive way of engaging in the world and with each other and in a very exploitive manner, trying to address that anxiety. And that a lot of those anxieties have come from a deep historic disconnection from our ecologies, a disconnection from a sense of spirit and meaning and place in society. And so that really kind of drove this understanding of needing to help avail tools that could perhaps engender a reconnection. And so that was a deep basis for getting early involved with the psychedelic work and finding our way to Johns Hopkins about 14 years ago, where we began funding trials with cancer anxiety and psilocybin. So cancer patients who are suffering existential distress and really beautifully finding that the psilocybin it did not just provide an instant cure or relief. It was a deep journey in reconciliation with one's deepest shadows and one's suffering and relationship to death and with cancer, and just a really, really poetic and beautiful way of empowering people on their own journey that wasn't just about taking away suffering, but helping people to grow through that crisis they had. And I'll try to wrap up quickly here, but sort of moving into my own graduate school, I, in psychology, again, really focusing on how a lot of our collective pathologies were really born from this breakdown of religion in our culture, and how religion used to really serve this holding of meaning, this fabric of meaning and place and purpose and community, and that the clergy were our, you know, they were our mental health professionals, and that there's been a significant collapse of really that whole structure of ideology and that cosmology that's left us bereft. And I think that was also a deep kind of basis for finding our way to supporting the Native American church as well. When I first met Sandor Ironrope, who was the president of the Native American Church of North America, and really learning more deeply about the Native American church and their history and their use of peyote, and discovering that there were these traditions, indigenous traditions, who, despite all the traumas and the colonialization and everything, all the difficulties that they faced, they managed to really preserve that thread of tradition and spirituality and having this really remarkable tool and ceremony and culture in place that could help reinforce and recondition and reconnect to the core elements of life, to the water, to the fire, to earth and air. And that for me personally, that this religion, and I'm almost emotional talking about that, this way of practicing spirituality was something that I'd always longed for, in a way that wasn't subscribing to this transcendent sort of sense of God that, you know, was just talked about, but actually being able to have a context to experience the divine as intimate and immediate and present. And so learning about it, I was just so moved to support their ways in any way that I could. And so trying to dig into that and really listen and learn and be patient and trying to really hear what they wanted and needed to continue. And what I came to discover is that what they wanted and needed most was support to ensure that they had continued access to their medicine, this powerful medicine that has helped them, you know, for tribes in Mexico for thousands of years, and more recently for the last 150 years in North America. And so that's kind of the background of what led us to make this big investment in IPCI and purchasing the land, this 605, as we call it, 605 acres down in Southwest Texas. And I do believe that, you know, circling back to this again, this collective anxiety that we're facing in the West, you know, I think that also stems from what we've done to Native American communities, that we've not taken time to slow down and have deep reconciliation, and that we just bulldozed so fast, you know, these landscapes and cultures and built up so quickly, and that we've cut ourselves off from what was here. And I think that's probably felt on a deep bodily level. And so starting to do this work of finding a way to not just give back, but empower those communities to come into health. And again, you know, all what they're asking for is just to have access to this medicine, peyote medicine, that has helped them so much, and to be, you know, to be left to pray in their way. Yeah, so it's just been a privilege and an honor beyond words to have gotten to participate and partner with the Native American leadership in this way.
That's beautiful. I'd love, Miriam, for you to sort of insert yourself into this timeline, share a little bit of your background, and when did you and Cody meet? And was it through the Indigenous Peyote Conservation Initiative? Is that how you guys met initially?
No, actually, how we met is, I'll utilize as a way of sharing a little bit about my background. I had the very good fortune of growing up north of San Francisco in the oak woodlands and redwoods of Sonoma County. And so got to grow up in a place that I was completely in love with and became academically trained to do ecological work, specifically working in agroecosystems and bringing sustainability into our food system. And I would say food and medicine system, because food is one of the very important medicines. And my focus in that arena, working on water, ag, and environment issues, has always been process. So community process, community health, doing multi-stakeholder work, bringing folks together who otherwise might be in conflict to really come into agreement about how their homes and their territories could be protected. And so one of the projects that I worked on was actually how to legalize and make available the ancient technology of composting our waste and composting toilets. And so that was how I met Cody. And you know, it's interesting coming from a process perspective and a process background as an ecologist, because it's really all about relationships. And so the way that I actually really entered into this work with River Styx was Cody invited me to come and serve as a facilitator to the National Council of Native American Churches in their conversations and strategy sessions around what to do around conservation. And so from there, they actually requested that I stay on as the sort of initiating director of the organization. And River Styx has continued to support me to be in that role. And, you know, this is a little bit about where our commitment to kind of expanding our ability to support Indigenous communities came from, because interestingly enough, it was really hard for funders to understand the value of supporting this, even though, you know, we were talking about communities with intact set and setting for microscopic amounts of money compared to the research on set and setting that's happening. You could actually support Native Americans to continue, like Cody said, having access to their medicine on their own terms. And then we started supporting assessment work and other kinds of projects in other places, like in Gabon, doing community-based assessment and conservation assessment with Iboga and with the Bwiti people. And we partnered at that time with ICERS and Bronners to support that assessment work, and learned that a lot of the issues there were very similar. The pressures from different kinds of industries, but also the psychedelic renaissance and the fact that Ibogaine was being this very successful medicine for opiate use disorder and PTSD with vets was already in just 10 years making major pressures on the populations there and impacting the ability of the local people, the Bwiti, Bantu, and Pygmy, to access their medicine the way they had for millennia. You know, in that case, you know, the Pygmies learned how to use Iboga from elephants, and then they taught the other tribes. And then we also began to do similar work in South America, in the Amazon basin, initially in Colombia and then other places. And we heard the same refrain, you know, where for various reasons, not just psychedelics, but also other pressures from, you know, basically colonial pressures, we can call it that, on their territory, it was becoming harder and harder for them, not just to access their medicine, but to conduct their way of life, to bring their culture as a living thing into the future, their languages, you know, as offerings to their children, as ways of managing their own mental health, identity, security, all of those things. And so as we got, you know, deeper into the learning process, which I know, Laura Dawn, you know, this is a learning process of how to really support these communities from a place where you're giving support, but you're not necessarily even giving guidance, right? Because you, when you do this work, you have to be in a big trusting relationship with people that they actually know from their own cultural ways what they need, but also providing some interface with the bigger world. And coming out of Colombia in particular, we were getting these very clear requests, not just for more money, but also, can you help us navigate dealing with funders when they come here because they want these things or they want us to change this and it's very complicated and it takes a lot of time. Technical support. We need support on figuring out how to do these like website things and budget things and like all these interface factors. Can you help us figure out how to get our message out there? Because it gets drowned out and it gets changed and it gets virtue signaled. I think that was a key word. And so, you know, out of hearing these requests for deeper, more substantive support, that was where the idea in collaboration with our partners for a vehicle that would serve as a really trusted way for there to be this interface between the broader sort of mainstream communities and these indigenous traditional knowledge holders. So anyways, that was a little bit technical, but that was essentially the, you know, the origin story for the fund. And then there were some very practical things like, how are we actually going to get this peyote conservation really fully supported? Because we can't do it on our own. And, you know, there are things like that. But really, there was a lot of requests from, you know, Indigenous groups to have something like this happen.
So there was the River Styx organization. And then I know Bronner's came in as just a huge support. And then from there, you decided how many years ago to say, okay, we are going to start the Indigenous Medicine Conservation Fund now as this vehicle for trust building.
Well, we actually started 3 years ago, but this brings up, you know, and Cody alluded to this. Sometimes when you're wanting to do really good, do no harm, right relationship, these are some of the terms we use, support, you can't go fast. And so, you know, we not only were we listening, but we also started talking to a lot of people on the ground around what would this look like? What kind of governance process would it have? We did a lot of research on that. And the initial thing we did actually remember, Cody, we had a series, we called it Indigenous Medicine Conservation Webinars. And that was like 3 years ago now, where we just wanted to highlight for funders some of the issues that were happening on the ground. And then we've continued to build from there.
Okay, great. And so the fund supports what we call five keystone medicines. And why do we call it a keystone medicine?
Well, keystone is one of these words that comes out of ecology, which describes, you know, an organism or a part of a system that has a particular kind of relationship in an ecosystem. So if it's a keystone organism or a keystone bioculture or a keystone medicine, it means that if it failed or went away or even is struggling, that everything else in the ecosystem is impacted by that. And so the reason why we're using that keystone bioculture language is because we're acknowledging that these are medicines, but also the biocultures around them, meaning the territory and the people and the ways and the ceremonial knowledge and the material knowledge and all of that. If those are weakened, then everything around them is weaker.
Mm-hmm. And that really points to this understanding that plant medicine conservation, even though it's amazing that people in the medicine and psychedelic communities are really starting to think about the importance of plant medicine conservation, that we actually even need to think bigger than that. Can you speak to that a little bit more of the importance for people to really get why we need to broaden our perspective on that?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's been one of the things that we've learned really deeply from the process of doing community-based assessment. So there's no indigenous medicine holding culture that says that it's just about a plant, right? It's always about that plant in the context of its territory, the other animals, the other plants that are there, in the context of its history and tradition with a particular group of people, the way it's passed from generation to generation, the ceremonial traditions, the way that information is passed in ceremony, like Cody referenced, the other elements, you know, water, air, fire, other herbs, other medicines that surround it, just the rhythm of things, seasonal rhythms. And so, you know, we have a tendency in Western culture to want to kind of pluck something, the really shiny part out of something. But one of the things that we've learned in these relationships is that you can't just conserve just this one, you know, kind of shiny part. It's everything. It's even the language, because the languages of these communities hold the knowledge about the nuance of the relationship between the medicines, the territory, and the people. And so, you know, moving into this kind of conservation, we have had to figure out how to navigate and also do education around the narrative around this. You know, we get really excited about ayahuasca, which is two plants, but really when we're engaging in a relationship with that medicine, there's a lot more there, right? There's the whole jungle and there's like so much knowledge and there's layers of knowledge. And, you know, we forget that somebody who works with ayahuasca and administers like a therapist, priest, doctor, you know, whatever analogy you want to make for their people with that medicine, those people have not only generational training, but 40, 50 years of training. There's a lot of knowledge there. And so that's one of the reasons why we really use this term bioculture, is because we can't actually go in and just, like, we had one of the funniest experiences in this process where, you know, and I think Cody can agree, we get all excited, oh my gosh, we can partner with this person and we'll do a plantation, we'll grow a whole bunch of medicine, it'll be all this great abundance. And that's beautiful. But then the folks say, well, actually, we don't have a problem growing our medicine. We know how to do that. We actually need support protecting our territory so we have access to it so that we can grow that medicine. And then you go, oh, right. So that's actually an example of having community direct their funding, because they actually know what the strategies are to be able to have access to their medicine for 100 years, you know, and those are the kinds of questions that we're asking in our assessments. So,
yeah. Cody, did you have something you wanted to add there?
Well, Miriam did illustrate that beautifully, but I was just going to share a little story about our process and, you know, and how there's been a lot of trust building both ways, you know, for these communities to really trust us and trying to learn and understand where we're coming from. It's not common or usual for philanthropists to step in this way. You know, I think so much has been taken from them. They're not used to something being given freely and openly. And so we're always having to do this sort of self-inquiry and self-checking of our intentions here and try to stay really, really clear and honest, you know, what we're getting out of it, even if it's, you know, the gratification of helping in this way and fulfilling our own meaning in our lives, wherever that's coming from. But the trust is the other way too, and trusting them. And I recall when we first started with the peyote work, we were really struggling to figure out what was the entry point into this conversation of really large scale conservation of the medicine, that there would be a real need to help restore in the order of magnitude of million plus medicine a year that had been taken every year out of the gardens. And how do we really get to a leveraged scale? And so we came across this land, this 605 acres, and it was apparent that there was tons of peyote on it. And we did an assessment with the cactologist, and he confirmed how great it was and how flush of medicine. And I said, well, great, you know, we have to get it. This is, you know, this is perfect. And I asked him, well, how long would that last the church? You know, how long would that sustain the church? And he said, well, you know, all the medicine could be harvested within a weekend.
Wow.
And I thought, oh my God, well, why would we do that? Why would we spend $1 million to buy this land if it's, you know, a drop in the bucket? We could spend that on greenhouses, $1 million worth of greenhouses, and, you know, get to leverage scale that way. And it was leadership of the Native American church quietly, you know, kept telling me, no, you know, land, you know, this is really important, and not really telling me why, but just the steady, firm commitment to how important that would be. And for us, it was a leap of faith. It was truly a leap of faith in trusting them, because from our perspective, we couldn't see what value that would have. And so we jumped and bought the land, and it's been really the turnkey of the whole project beyond anything we could have ever expected, because it was real. It made the whole conversation real and allowed something that we never could have anticipated, which is a safe home for the Native American communities, Native American church communities, to be able to pray to their medicine on the ground, you know, in its natural habitat, which they haven't had for, you know, ostensibly the past 50 to 100 years since it's all been privatized, all that land, and how challenging it is to have access to the land, and how much disconnect there's been. So this is just an illustration of really the trust both ways. And even if we can't understand the value of something, to be able to really listen to those communities and really trust them, and, you know, buying this land and it just being the turnkey, opening all these conversations with local ranchers too, who saw us as a neighbor now and was willing to talk to us, and being able to get leases on other ranch lands to be able to manage their peyote fields in a conservation perspective. And, you know, that extends to just the whole conversation around decrim nature and this real conflict that we've been in around, you know, keeping peyote off the list of medicines to be decriminalized. And, you know, maybe from, you know, our Western perspective, me and Miriam, maybe that doesn't, you know, we're, you know, liberal Californians and, you know, don't want people to be arrested. And at the same time, we really heard like very, very clearly from Native Americans, you know, the point of them being, you know, emotional about how scary that is to have their medicine being unlocked and available to white consumers, and how dangerous and threatening that felt to them, and really getting behind that voice, even if it was a difficult battle to fight and a place to stand in. And so, yeah, again, to illustrate the trust that's had to take place really both ways.
And I feel like this really speaks to what you're doing differently with the Indigenous Medicine Conservation Fund that truly is Indigenous led. And I think the conventional approach is like, I want to show up, I'm going to help, and I'm going to throw money at helping. And what you guys are doing is fundamentally different. You're showing up based on an invitation to engage in a conversation, and you're showing up to listen and to basically follow the lead of these Indigenous leaders.
Yeah, I mean, I think the form of the governance of the fund, really, we've worked to exemplify that, kind of codify or put that into structure so that it can last. Because I think for us, Cody and I and the rest of the River Styx team and Bronner's as the philanthropy side, doing this work to capacitate and help this organization form is really about an offering. And our imagination is that in a couple years, we'll continue to do fundraising, but the operations of this organization, the ongoing assessment, the technical support on the ground, the choosing of not just projects, but also strategies in regions will all be under the direction of Indigenous people. And already, or whoever they choose, right? And already we have a governance structure where we have a conservation committee that's made up of representatives from each of the biocultures, sometimes more than one because they get complex enough that we need to have more than one, and also technical advisors who are deeply experienced in being in that kind of bridge-making role where they can bring in the technical pieces, but they know how to navigate respectfully in these communities. And that conservation committee, not me, not Cody, not David Bronner, make the decisions about where the funding goes. And it's really a different philanthropic paradigm. You know, Cody said, you know, trusting. It's like trusting. And sometimes we don't know exactly which way those decisions are going to go. And that's really, really, really okay. And we're even pushing the limits of kind of conventional philanthropy to the point where we have people who are recipients. Their communities are recipients of funds who serve on that conservation committee because they deeply know what's needed. However, they are held and responsible to their communities. You know, one of our conservation committee members has 1,000 spiritual leaders that he answers to.
Wow.
In community. Another person, the woman who is in the Iboga seat, she's a young woman, but the communities are so stressed and competitive there that they came together and agreed that actually this young woman who would be able to hold representing everybody. So each person who's there has a commitment to be integrity to that. They're not representative in the like tribal government sense, but just representative to their community and bioculture. And so that's a pretty unique philanthropic structure. And to show you how that goes, we first had to create a structure that we could get going in. And then the conservation committee that was formed took that structure, took all our processes, even the way the mission and vision was written, all of the language about how we communicate about assessments, how we communicate about the threats and opportunity, all of that. And they reworked it to actually be fully theirs. And so, you know, and that brings up the pacing. And of course, it's not just a philanthropic vehicle for folks in the psychedelic space, but I think it's particularly important to point out that the psychedelic space is moving very, very quickly. And it's been a challenge, and I think will continue to be a challenge to make sure that we're honoring the pace of governance in these communities while navigating really supporting the psychedelic community to hear these narratives around benefit sharing, around the responsibility to actually maintain and ensure access into the future of these communities while the pacing is slightly different, right? The pacing of Silicon Valley and the pacing of this iterative, representative, Indigenous worldview process, they're very different. So a lot of the work of our staff, people like me and Cody and, you know, Ben DeLonen, who's come on as co-director, is kind of handling some of the friction and timing of all these things. So.
And so for people in the medicine community, the psychedelic community, whether people are guides or facilitators or companies or organizations, I think it's amazing that there's starting to be more conversation right now about reciprocity, but why did you as a fund decide to not lead with reciprocity as a word that you're using and instead focus on benefit sharing and right relationship?
Well, maybe I'll take this first, and then I think Cody can comment on this really well, but I think the question we were asking ourselves, and we ask it in other arenas at RiverStyx, is, okay, if you really look out 100 years, where we're going to be with this psychedelic movement that's happening, and what do we want? And then also, you know, Laura Dawn, as a systems thinker, then what are some of the unintended consequences? And it's unequivocally clear that if we get 40 or 50 years down the road and the psychedelic movement or all of that actually just put pressure, more pressure on these communities and skipped over the opportunity to do benefit sharing and even change some of their behaviors, that it was gonna, I don't know, for lack of a better word, just feel terrible. Sometimes I've been being a little bit dramatic and say it will have failed because it will have caused more trauma than, you know, MDMA or any of these it could ever address. And I don't know that, you know, but it's being a little dramatic. But I think really it was that serious, where this was really, really urgently important to address. And it's not just pressure on these territories. It's also pressure on people's medicine sovereignty and biological heritage rights. It's very, very scary for people in these communities when their medicines are being medicalized and pulled apart because they think of them as relatives, right? So, you know, when somebody's very excited and coming from a beautiful, well-intentioned place and wants to commercialize ayahuasca, that causes trauma in a lot of ayahuasca communities, and they get very, very concerned about what's happening. So just starting to think about, okay, this, all these tracks are happening. Where's the right relationship between them? And so then actually it's probably like four or five years ago now in relation to mescaline, somebody in one of our board meetings asked a question about intellectual property rights and what they were. And we started looking at what is WIPO, what is the World Intellectual Property Organization, and how does it impact Indigenous people? And come to discover 176 countries are signers to the Nagoya Protocol and the Biodiversity Protocols. And they spent 35 years developing a framework for ensuring that biological and genetic material, as well as cultural art that was used for business benefit, that there were ethical standards for how people would engage then with the Indigenous communities who have those heritage connections to those things. You know, an example would be if you're using an Aboriginal art all over your hotel, then you're supposed to honor the artist and give back. And so we started looking at how this applied. And so that's where this idea of benefit sharing comes from, is that, oh, you know, if there's companies or even individuals who are getting benefit from these things that are acknowledged in an international framework as part of Indigenous people's rights, then let's start encouraging that use of the framing of benefit sharing as opposed to reciprocity, which kind of implies consent and implies that there's a whole relationship and exchange going, and that benefit sharing doesn't in the same way imply that there's has been a consent process, and it acknowledges that there might not have been, and that just seemed important and clear. And our partners in the communities have agreed with that and wanted to see that language change.
Yeah, I think that was just beautifully put. And I, you know, just in terms of semantics, I like that point that, you know, reciprocity does assume some kind of consent of something given back. And I think we wanted to come at this with a true place of giving. And without saying that outright, I think benefit sharing really, really hits that sweet spot. And I would say even further, you know, one word that I think Miriam and I did want to use early on, and I think we feel deep in our hearts, and this is, it's tricky language because there's often shame associated with it, but reparations, you know, I think this is an important thing to say and to name, and that we shouldn't forget of what has been taken from these communities and how little has been really given back to support them. I mean, even just in the philanthropic field, 0.05% of all philanthropic dollars goes to support Native American communities. And a lot of that doesn't even reach those communities directly. It's funneled through institutions and academic organizations. And so it just, you know, I think there is a place for honoring all that the West has come to, again, to benefit from of these lands. And I feel as a philanthropist, you know, having benefited and holding these resources that came directly from the fruits of this land, you know, the very, very least that I can do as a philanthropist is to ensure that they have continued access to a medicine that they rely on for their healing. And that we as a psychedelic community have come to, you know, to really get very optimistic and on board with the understanding that these are healing medicines, and we're validating that in our own scientific parlance. And if we really accept that these are healing medicines, why wouldn't we, by extension, want to ensure that those Native American communities that have been so hurt by our actions have access to those medicines in their own frame? And that's really where we come from in this.
Right. And each of the keystone medicines face such nuanced, complex, different challenges and threats. And so even just trying to educate about what those threats are to the audience that are so different has been, yeah, such an interesting journey as well. I also love this term solidarity-based support. This has been really just what I've learned along the way of what it means to offer support in a way that these cultures and that these communities are asking for. And so I just wanted to presence that term as well, because benefit sharing in a way that is based on solidarity-based support is a way that they are leading the discussion on how these communities are asking for support.
I think that there's this incredible moment right now where a lot of things are up in the air. There's a lot of learning happening. There's a lot of exploring happening. And maybe moments like this don't happen all the time. But, you know, as an ecologist, I kind of think of it a little bit as like there's some disruption that's happened. And so there's an opportunity before things get solidified and some of our structures get in place around how medicalization is going to work and how new legal frameworks are going to work and, you know, how therapeutic models are going to happen and all of that. There's this kind of moment of an opportunity to really, it's not just about bringing in different narratives, but also support different ways of thinking about things and kind of weave in and include that things like benefit sharing would just be, of course, and automatic. And, you know, they're built into governance models and philanthropic models and, you know, and all of that. And so, so I think solidarity-based support, where it's based on listening to and being with the communities that you're addressing their concerns, is this is kind of the moment to do that. All the listening that we can do, all the creation of good structures that we can do, hopefully we'll be able to have really an impact, you know, 10, 15 years from now about how we all do things. And so I think part of why we're looking at this kind of philanthropic model and looking at this offering is so that it's in place and solid in a few years.
And it would be amazing if all psychedelic companies in the space would be able to give a percentage of earnings back. And do you think that's enough? Like if a company is and I won't name some of the big names, but if they're like, I'm donating 10% to be in reciprocity and it's going to XYZ, do you think that's enough?
Well, I'll tackle this. I think that, no, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's a wonderful thing, but what we've been talking about this whole past hour is about listening. And so I think there's some pieces that need to be picked up, and I don't want to speak for people right now because we're still learning about this, but what I hear on the ground in the communities that we're supporting, and I think what we're hearing through our engagement in the fund is that there may be some things that we're doing, just forging ahead doing, that actually don't need to be done. You know, Cody brought up decriminalized nature. It's been, the decriminalization effort. That's actually a change in perspective to understand that you can be completely for, you know, freeing the relationship between humans and plants and be for cognitive liberty and consider the history and the particular moment in time that we're in and just step back and allow, in this case, Native Americans to be the people who take the lead and do all the decision-making on any regulatory policy or legislative change related to their medicine. And you can just say, you can just step back and just respect that. And sometimes it's okay to just have a boundary like that and not just go after your own curiosity or liberty that you, you know, rights go along with responsibilities. So, you know, I think some of the message of this and some of the, I don't know, understanding that I hope comes into this space through this conversation is that it's not just about rights. It's also about responsibility, and it's about treating each other like family. If you're in a family, you don't say, well, my rights are more important than your trauma or your experience or your, you know, whatever, you know, like when there's kids in a family, sometimes it's okay to say to one of the kids, that person just got that toy for their birthday, and so let them play with it. And I'm not equating those two things, but it's just like, we don't all have to, it's okay to treat each other like family, I think is what I'm trying to say, not totally articulately. And when somebody says we need to be in charge of this, it's at the middle of our culture and identity, everybody else can just say, okay. You know, and if this is supposed to be a healing endeavor, you know, it seems like we need to step up and do those things.
And the fund as a vehicle, because obviously not everyone in the psychedelic community or companies or organizations can go down and build a relationship with Indigenous cultures, nor do I think any of us want that, and or cultures down there want that. And so is the fund a good opportunity for companies to be donating to or just big philanthropists? And I'm curious if you might be open to speaking to why the fund won't just take money from anyone.
Well, this is why we have a governance structure. I think both neither Cody nor I, and certainly River Styx, are not going to pretend like we know the right things about this. We just really want the support to get there and enough of it, right? And in a way that feels good to the people on the ground and is in integrity with their cultures. So this is an example of why we have a governance structure like we do. If there was a question about this, then we pass it to that, into our governance structure, and they figure out. And the way that they've worked on it so far is there's a basic set of criteria around, you know, no companies that are engaged in like really extractive industries. But then there's also conversations. I think the fund is going to be able to serve a role of helping to educate, you know, companies in the space, sharing about the principles that are in the Nagoya Protocol and that are in the United Nations Indigenous Rights, sharing about that there might be other options, you know. And so, yeah, that's how I would respond. It's like, that's what we've created, And different communities are going to be different. Different cultures are going to be okay with some things, and other cultures aren't going to be okay with those things. And it's just not our job to say what those things are. It's our job to support there being a vehicle for some of those things, those interfaces, to get worked out without really doing a big disruption in the communities, right?
And that it's really an honor and a privilege to give money.
Yeah. It really is. And I really have to say emphatically how unique of an opportunity this is, and a rare kind of moment in history and the connections that have been made. I'm just, you know, even thinking about our partner who founded Nerdica in Mexico, and just all the just years and years of tireless effort and bridge building that they've been doing. For instance, with Wiradica, Huichol communities throughout Mexico, and really forging these deep, longstanding connections, and doing, you know, very much on the ground work, you know, showing up, driving days to these remote communities to give them cash for gas money, and just these little ways that are so meaningful and so important, and that's what's really needed there, and building that foundation of trust, and then us River Styx being able to work with Nerica and to have these, you know, really well honed channels of where funding can make its way to communities in a trusted and high integrity way. It's really remarkable, and same by extension to, you know, appreciating ICEERS and what they've done in ayahuasca communities and Yahe in Colombia and with the Bwiti in Gabon, you know, and we've done a lot of that legwork. And I'll give credit to NARF, you know, the Native American Rights Fund, who has stood by the Native American Church for decades in their legal fights. And so we've just been, I think, really blessed to partner with these organizations who have honed these long-term partnerships and have a really trusted pathway for funds to flow. And I would say that's extremely rare and probably one of the greatest gifts of the fund. And it's hard to communicate that, but you know, for anyone who is interested in this work to try to make their way into their communities without these connections, it's very difficult and money can be disruptive. We've seen that over and over. And despite our best intentions, you know, our presence has created a lot of disruption and a lot of schism and distrust. And, you know, we're just patiently trying to forge ahead and keep showing up and trying to reinstill confidence of our intentions again. But there needs to be a lot of care with how resources are deployed and to whom, and to stay really nimble in doing that.
I think there's so many things that make the IMC Fund incredibly unique and unprecedented. And I would love to unpack a little bit for people listening who might have some distrust around where their funds go. And part of what you're doing is this incredible assessment process. And I don't even actually want to use this word vetting. I think I used to be more in that mindset of like, well, how do we vet the organizations? But what you're doing is actually so much more relational based, where you're really showing up and partnering and allying with these communities and these initiatives. And so I'd love to share a little bit about that assessment, the needs assessment, the community-based assessment that the fund does, and why it's so different than just a pass-through vehicle for money to come in and just go to organizations, that you're really intricately involved in that process.
Mm-hmm. And Miriam can detail this. You know, from just a high level, I'll just share just the true joy of getting to really partner with Native American communities, that this isn't just about giving money. This is really grappling, you know, sitting in board meetings you know, multiple times a year and going down to the lands and really, you know, and working it out together, that these are really viewed as collective shared resources that we are partnering with together to make these projects alive. And it's really a beautiful process to be in that level of shared power and responsibility and really creative collaboration. It's, again, I think it's just such a unique and rare opportunity. Miriam can say a lot more of the details of how that works.
Yeah, well, you kind of, you know, you heard in that there's these relationships, you know, that are a lot about, you know, showing up, being honest, listening, right? And then what we've done is the community-based assessments that you're describing. An example of that, like in Peru, where there was a whole set of questions that were generated around, you know, what do we need in order to still be here in 100 years? What do we need to be stronger? Here's what's happening in the psychedelic world. What is that going to mean for our medicine? How do we want to relate to it? Here's what's happening with climate change. How does our medicine and our traditional knowledge help us engage with that? What do we need in place? You know, these kind of questions. And then those were worked with a group of Shipibo youth by our technical team. And our biggest expense for the community-based assessment in the Shipibo communities were a couple boats. And then those youth went out into the communities with flip charts, one of my favorite community tools. I love flip charts with all those questions in Shipibo. And people sat around and ate food and talked about these things. And then the youth captured them on the flip charts. And then those were turned into an assessment report, at least for the needs assessment part, right? Like, this is what the elders say they need. This is what the youth say they need. Here's where they overlap. And we did similar work in Gabon and other areas. And, you know, you find this territory, language, access, territory, language, access, our voices being heard, interface across all of the biocultures. You know, and each of the medicines we're working with have their own flavor. I mentioned before in the Mazatec Sierra, we're going extremely slowly. We had very formal letters go out first asking if people were open to having some technical advisors come into their villages to ask them if they wanted to do a community-based assessment and what they might be assessing, right? So that's a little bit of how the community-based kind of, we're calling it sort of primary research. But then all of that data gets processed by the technical teams along with some of the partners on the ground. And then it goes to the conservation committee. And the conservation committee actually listens to all of this information, listens to the recommended strategies on the ground, listens to the recommendations for which projects are kind of either already holding a big piece or maybe with some support they would step into it, right? There's a lot of that. Or if there's some other organization that needs to be formed, like in Gabon, we're finding that there's this interesting process happening where the Bwiti Healers Association is seeing that they need to have some kind of body that handles this kind of benefit sharing, but can do it in a way that addresses everybody's needs. So the conservation committee really works a lot with that material. The technical team supports each organization or community component that was proposed or discovered through the assessment to develop, you know, a proposal that the conservation committee can actually look at. Does the translation, you know, because sometimes they're in Inga or a different language. And then the committee works these proposals together until they're in consensus about either a 3-year commitment, a 1-year commitment, which involves a lot of further engagement, or we need to get to know this group better. And then the technical committee stays involved with all of those categories of partners.
That's incredible. And you mentioned language, which is so important. And why should we be considering the preservation of languages?
Well, again, Miriam can detail this more, but this is a big one for me, again, as a philanthropist, and why I'm so committed to this work. I mean, just from an experiential perspective, to be in these meetings and be in board meetings and sitting down at lunch together and around the table, there being Dene spoken and Lakota and, you know, Cheyenne and just the plurality and just the diversity and beauty of all these languages that are situated in a completely different sort of paradigm than our Germanic roots. And I think there's just something so precious about just cultural diversity in and of itself. And that's what a lot of this is just through empowering people with their medicines to ensure that those communities are strengthened to fight their fights, to hold on and to be able to empower their communities with language and language education. Just from a deep value perspective, you know, language is always, it sustains my love for this work. And just hearing them and people fly all over the world to experience, you know, different cultures and different peoples. But right here in our own communities, you know, we have, like Miriam said, you know, the family that we don't attend to and don't attempt to really connect with. So I'm very grateful for this work in that way.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the issues that we have to talk about, whether we want to or not, within the fund and within these issues is intellectual property. And one of those, you know, you have those little paradigm shifting moments where you catch on to something. I was helping to escort one of our partners in the POD work to speak to the World Intellectual Property Organization about mescaline and intellectual property. And so the question was going around to quite a number of people, including him, about, well, just what is this intellectual property and is there ownership? And language and culture are part of the intellectual capacity of human beings to understand how to navigate living on this planet and in the particular territory that you happen to live in. And so cultural knowledge is deeply embedded and completely intertwined with language and worldview and ways of understanding things. So, and that means like how to survive and thrive in a particular territory. And that is part of what our human intellects are for. And so if people don't have their language, it's really hard to say that they have their culture in full. Culture in the sense of a container for understanding how to navigate living in the world, right? And so, you know, from an ecological lens, you know, in this moment of the sixth greatest extinction and human mediated damage across the board, these languages are incredibly precious. They are the intellectual knowledge about how to engage in the world. And so, you know, if we want to support these communities thriving into the future, you know, and we've talked about some of the reasons why that might be important, language is central and essential. Without a language, how can a grandmother teach a grandchild a cultural story or way of relating to plant or a way of navigating the world if not in their own language, you know? And then I've also heard many of our partners talk about the way that they pass their particular relationships to that medicine is tied to the language that they speak to in that language. Those are medicine languages. That's the way they address their medicine. And that's what they hear back from their medicine. So really, really important to all of that and to identity and everything.
Mm. Okay, so just to start kind of coming to a close here, so you're in the middle of a big lift. You have a 20 million raise on the Indigenous Medicine Conservation Fund. You are doing an incredible job. How many projects are on the roster that the fund is supporting amongst the five Keystone medicines?
Well, there's 24 right now, but the intention is to do ongoing assessment and bring in other projects, but 24 right now.
Okay, that's amazing. Is there anything else that we didn't cover about maybe blind spots that you would love illuminated in the medicine psychedelic community, as a lot of individuals are going to be listening to this?
Well, I'll share one. I mean, and maybe we already covered this, but I think our offering at River Styx of this to both people in the field as a good vehicle and people in the traditional knowledge holding communities as a trusted mechanism for receiving support and getting their voices uplifted. I just think that in 10 years from now, 15 years from now, if we had really robust, if this was really, really robust, it would address so many things and provide so many benefits that I just hope it's successful. That's just all I really have to say. For all the reasons we've been talking about.
Yeah, I agree. And that, you know, again, from a just a philanthropic perspective, it's hard to find, again, opportunities, you know, to go into Native communities and try to understand the complexity of challenges they face with healthcare and diabetes and low life expectancy and lack of economic opportunities and lack of access to food and no food sovereignty and just on and on and on. It really becomes confusing about how to enter thoughtfully and constructively. And, you know, again, just I really have come to feel that getting behind these medicines and helping at the very least, again, to ensure that they have sustainable access to these powerful medicines that are so supportive psycho-spiritually, to help them navigate all these other different systems and complexities in their lives. It really feels like empowering Indigenous people to be fortified in their activism against this, you know, perpetual fight and struggle against the dominant, you know, capitalistic forces that are always threatening to take their lands and diminish their cultures. And so I think it's a really, really important place to put funding, and River Styx has pledged $1 million in addition to the million we offered to buy the land in Texas, and Bronner's has matched us with another million, and we've raised, I think it's about five or five and a half now, Miriam, is that right?
Yeah. 5.8.
5.8.
Go team. Yes.
But, you know, are greatly, greatly in need of other philanthropists and donors of all levels to be engaged. And that's why, you know, Laura, you're coming in and helping to partner with us with Grow Medicine has just been it's such a blessing. Actually, it was remarkable because Miriam and I had visioned this way of connecting consumers and connecting individuals who are engaging and benefiting from these medicines to have a way of directly sharing that benefit and reciprocating and giving back to those communities. And you know, and to hear that you had already sort of started to build the infrastructure for that and in such a beautiful way, Grow Medicine was a perfect partner to avail this other dimension of access for individuals. And I would just really encourage everyone to check it out at Grow Medicine and just how beautiful this offering is.
Yeah.
Thank you, Cody. Well, the prayer was strong and the synchronicities aligned. And obviously Spirit was like, okay, we're going to align you with these incredible people who are doing it in the best way possible. And I know I could write a book at this point about the blind spots that have been illuminated for me in the past 8 months. And I really just want to thank you, Miriam, in particular, because you've been such an incredible mentor and I've learned so much from you in this past year. Mm-hmm. It's been incredible to just see how much wisdom and knowledge that you have. And I'm appreciating getting to know you as well, Cody. And so maybe we could just end and I can include this snippet. If you want to add anything about Grow Medicine, Miriam, just encouraging people to check it out and we can kind of end on that note.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is a moment to define the legacy of the psychedelic movement and how all of us, whether big funders, companies, our participants in Grow Medicine can engage and take on the honor of doing benefit sharing. It will make an unequivocal difference to what the legacy of this movement is.
Thank you. Yeah, so really encouraging people who are listening, if you have bigger funds and you would love to be involved in this movement on that level, then going to imc.fund. There is a lot of great information there. And if you are an individual facilitator guide in the space, going to growmedicine.com is a great way to get involved and share in the benefits that you have received from these wonderful medicines and giving back to the traditional knowledge holders from which these medicines come. So thank you both so much. That was wonderful.
Thank you, Laura Dawn. Thank you for everything.
Thank you. Hi, friends. Thank you so much for tuning into another episode of the Psychedelic Leadership Podcast. If you want to learn more about the Indigenous Medicine Conservation Fund, you can go to imc.fund. To learn more about Grow Medicine, you can go to growmedicine.com. And please be sure to follow Grow Medicine on Instagram at @supportgrowmedicine. If you've been enjoying the show, I would so appreciate it if you could subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts or take a moment to leave me a review on iTunes. I'm going to leave you with this song called The Power of Kindness. I love this song. Please feel it in your heart. I encourage you to give and to share in the benefits that you've received from these incredible plant medicines and to support Indigenous-led initiatives to allow their communities to thrive for generations to come. This song, The Power of Kindness, is by Mamuse. They are incredible musicians. Pretty much every song that they release is so uplifting and so inspiring. So I also highly encourage you to check them out on Spotify. All right, friends, that's all from me for today. Once again, my name is Laura Dawn, and you're listening to the Psychedelic Leadership Podcast. Until next time.
Ooh, I believe in the power of love. Ooh, I believe in the power of kindness. Ooh, I believe in the power of love. We don't know what's coming, but we can help shape what's ahead. Kindness as our currency, the commonwealth is in our hands. So give a little all, give a lot. A helping hand makes the world go round. There's more than enough. Ooh, I believe in the power of kindness. Ooh, I believe in the power of love. Power of love. Ooh, I believe in the power of kindness. Ooh, I believe in the power of love. Look up now, people. But keep your ear to the ground. We are the river flowing, generosity abounds. So give a little all, give a lot, don't stop. A helping hand makes the world go round. There's more than enough. Ooh, I believe in the power of kindness. Ooh, I believe in the power of love. Of love. Ooh, I believe in the power of kindness. Ooh, I believe in the power of
honeybees serve sweetness only to help the world bloom. Bringing love to the flower, from the flower to the fruit, we can learn a thing or two. So give a little, all, give a lot, don't stop. A helping hand makes the world go round, there's more than enough. Ooh, I believe in the power of kindness. Ooh, I believe in the power of love, power of love. Ooh, I believe in the power of kindness. Ooh, I believe in the power of love. We don't know what's coming, we can help shape what's ahead. Kindness as our currency, the commonwealth is in our hands. So give a little all, give a lot, don't stop. A helping hand makes the world go round.